Okay, so I just need to do a sound check because I don't think we can hear you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me?
Oh, now we can. Yep. Thank you very much. All right. And counsel, can you hear and see opposing counsel?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And you've got the screen over there. Okay. In that case, we're ready to hear argument when you're ready to present.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nicolette Glazer appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellants. May I reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal?
Certainly may, but please keep track of your own time on the clock.
Yes. Before this court is a case of a first impression, an interpretation of a brand new statute passed to alleviate a great economic harm during a pandemic, a deadly pandemic. Applying the novel review, we ask this court to reverse and remand to the district court for further proceedings. When construing a statute, a court must start with its text. The reason for that is simple. Legislatures express their purpose through the word they enact into law. Notion of administrative deference must not stretch federally enacted statute to reach places that that Congress did not intend or imagine it will be interpreted. Blind deference include mischief from administrative agencies because of the expectation that post-hoc racialization will be accepted. This is what led the district court astray. A determination in this case will require the court to examine three separate federal statutes, the CARES Act, the Small Business Act, and the Immigration and Nationality Act. In enacting the CARES Act, Congress did not define eligibility for emergency ID alone by the immigration status of their incorporators or shareholders. But the Congress spoke directly on the issue on a related relief in the statute when it decided that child tax credit can only be granted to non-resident but if they had social security number. Now that is relevant, Your Honor, because Title 42, Section 405 defines how and who can get a social security number, and that is non-citizens who are either employment authorized, incident to their status, or are granted low work permit. So Congress in the CARES Act did not relate to qualified aliens, and I'm using the term as is defined in the INA, or to the status of the individual by specific immigrant or non-immigrant status, but expanded a category that is not present in priora. If the court will look up our section 1641, you will see that the definition of qualified alien is entirely based on an immigration status, not at all based on their employment authorization. So the agency was not free to disregard what Congress put in the CARES Act. Equally, the Small Business Act, the act that they are in, authorized and empowered to...
Counsel, under your interpretation, under the CARES Act, is there anything that prevents the SBA from providing the benefit to a foreign company outside the United States?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it is clear that the entity, the eligible entity, must be in the United States.
Under what provision of the CARES Act does it say that?
Well, Your Honor, it goes into that it is an extension of the Small Business Act, and Small Business Act specifically states that small business concerns must be in the United States.
Right. So you are conceding that the CARES Act is implemented in the background rules and legislation that was provided by Congress previously. So why not Priora? I don't know how you say that statute, but that's how I've been saying it.
I don't know either, Your Honor, but what I wanted to say about Priora is Priora is not part of the Small Business Act. It is part of the INA. But the question is, Priora has never been applied to corporations, first, and second, never been applied, part of the INA, or the Immigration Nationality Act, had never been applied to foreign, to United States corporations. What we have here, Your Honor, is...
Was that issue raised below?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether or not Priora applies to corporations?
Yes. Yes, specifically raised, the government did not address, and the district court did not address it.
Yeah, let me just ask that again, because it was extensively raised by you, but I don't read the district court opinion to address it at all.
He did not, Your Honor, and the government also did not respond to that argument.
Is there any motion to reconsider?
we have not filed. It seems that the judge was pretty set in the way he saw the case, so we didn't do that, Your Honor.
In the trial, perhaps it was, in the trial court, it looked like there's a little bit of a confusion in a, under a heading that's labeled as a constitutional claim. This is presented. Can you tell me how does this become a constitutional claim?
Well, Your Honor, what we argued in that particular case is that the corporation has the right to a notice and opportunity to be heard. And the corporation and anybody applied for it were never given an opportunity or an idea why they will be denied, because this particular rule that we challenged was never publicized. It actually did not get put into the public record until after we filed the lawsuit. And so there was never an opportunity for an applicant to overcome this blanket unverified denial that they sent people, saying, well, something in the application raises concern about the veracity. I mean, that sounds pretty nefarious, and my clients interpreted there was some sort of a concern about that they have committed something inappropriate.
Counsel, if in fact, although not in the administrative record, if they had that rule before your clients applied, so in an SOP of 2015, would that adjust your position?
No, Your Honor, because, again, the court must look at what the rule are we challenging. The rule is in paragraph 103, and it says that only people who are eligible for, only companies that are eligible for ADL loan is if their shareholder incorporators are U.S. citizen, legal permanent resident, or have a receipt for an approved adjustment of status, or 751, the 790C receipt. Those are the four categories put in the rule. Nowhere does it mention qualified alien. And in our reply in Table 2, we actually put the actual rule that was implemented with 1641 and 1611. And as the court will see, that neither refugee, asylee, people who have parole with more than 1 year of validity, a certain Haitian and Cuban entrant under IRCA, nor people who are granted status under VAWA or trafficking were included. So these people would be qualified alien, but the rule that they applied would have excluded their company. So, if this rule is in existence, it was never existed before the 2020 SOP, which is Exhibit B to our motion for judicial notice. That is what is the problem. In the previous practice, the agent has swayed back and forth for certain issue, and we put them in our Table 1. And it was not until 2019, the first time, that the agency grouped corporation with partnership and sole proprietorship. And we will admit that a sole proprietor or a partnership could properly be asked the question of incorporator, because technically it flows to the individual. And the individual.
Counsel, can I return you to the question I had earlier about Perora? I thought your argument was that Perora didn't even apply, and that CARES Act doesn't incorporate it. But now you're saying Perora does apply, but it doesn't apply to corporations. Is that right?
Well, what we said right from the beginning is the Perora could not apply in the context of corporations.
I guess that's my problem. I don't think I saw that in your opening brief. I thought that the argument in the opening brief is that Perora just doesn't apply at all.
I believe that is the case, because Perora has never been applied to corporations.
Was that argument made in your opening brief?
Honor, I believe that we responded to that, because that was the only argument raised by the respondents, but I have to check, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
That seems like it might be waived if it's not in the opening brief. So if you want to double check at some point.
I will check, Your Honor. But again, the question in the lower court actually did not address the issue at all. It did not address whether the Immigration and Nationality Act applied to corporations. That is specifically raised, and that was specifically raised in the opening brief. And that is the starting point.
But not in our opening brief.
In our opening brief, we specifically raised the issue that the Immigration
Nationality
in the district court. And I can get the specific presentation. We specifically argued also the case law, and that there is a settled precedent that neither an agency or a court can disregard the corporate formation. So
this is a pure question of law. It's a question of statutory interpretation. And it unequivocally was raised below in the district court.
Yes.
And then it's fully engaged by the government in its red brief.
That is correct.
And then you respond in the reply brief.
I did your
Can you
I
think of any? Can you think of any case in the Ninth Circuit where that wouldn't be considered an issue of law that was preserved for us to decide?
Your Honor, I believe my research has indicated that in the Ninth Circuit, issue of statutory interpretation is reviewed de novo by this court, and there is no deference out to.
Has the government urged that you waive this? Has the government said that this issue is forfeited somehow?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, wasn't it only raised in the reply brief?
Your Honor, we specifically, I mean, I will go back to my appeal and I will submit a specific pinpoint citation, but we, I
yeah, that would be helpful. If it's in your opening brief, that would be helpful for me.
I will certainly look into when I take the time to reply, but also I will submit it to the court, and if I'm incorrect, I will submit it in a notice to the court. But my recollection in preparation today, that we specifically argued that corporate formation cannot be disregarded and that the INA does not apply to corporations.
Are you going to stick with it? It's a fascinating issue, and it's very, very consequential. As you know, I'm not from here. I'm from the Fifth Circuit, so hurricanes come through frequently. We have a lot of U.S. companies that employ U.S. citizens that are licensed in good standing and pay taxes, and yet hurricanes hit. And so the consequence of the government's argument, as I would read it, would be that none of these employers of U.S. citizens paying taxes are eligible. So it's an extraordinarily important issue of law. That said, you do have another plaintiff, and the district court dismissed as to STAM purely on standing. So I'm really interested in whether Ninth Circuit law would justify the district court's ruling. As I see it, the district court didn't cite any law as to that, but there is quite a bit of law.
Well, Your Honor, I will start, if I may, very quickly with Supreme Court's law and Supreme Court's precedent. And I believe the problem with the district court's ruling on standing is threefold. First, it is well said that the one plaintiff in a multi-party lawsuit requires to have a standing. At the motion to dismiss stage, the judge found that the common carrier have standing as to all their claim. Second, it is well settled that the court cannot use merits determination for purposes of standing. So here the judge found that the rule that we're challenging does not exist. That is the quintessential merits question. It is not a standing. It's, in fact, for purposes of standing, I believe the Supreme Court in the last pronouncement, that is the Ted Cruz case, said we have to accept that the plaintiff will prevail for purposes of standing. So here the district court not only had to accept that this rule applies, but the applicant was subjected to that rule. And the third one issue is that we believe is relevant here for purposes of standing is that the main argument of the district court is that the STAM company was given an opportunity to reopen their adjudication. That happened during the litigation. And I believe the Ted Cruz case that came this term, I believe, specifically rejected the specific argument that was raised by the government below that self-inflicted injury somehow eliminates standing. And I believe these three arguments that are supported by Supreme Court decision, Weldon, Ted Cruz, and I believe the merits one is again Stendon, and I believe it is Heaven Realties.
Yeah, counsel, my issue with standing was the traceability front. It seems like the reason why your STAM's application was denied because it didn't follow up on that email that said, you know, go ahead and follow up. And so how's this traceable to the no amendment policy?
Your Honor, if you look at the complaint, before this email was sent, the day before, the government has already denied that STAM application.
But still it's saying you should go ahead and follow through and amend it. And then STAM didn't do that, and that's why it was denied.
Well, actually, I have to disagree, Your Honor. What we have here is an effort by the subcontractor, the people who are on the phone, to try to input the information. That information never got put into the system because of the mandatory rules. So there's no ability to amend. The only thing after that, he did open up a possibility for people to seek formal reconsideration. That happened, I believe, in 2021. And so,
what about the email that to Stan that said, I forget exactly what it said, but doesn't it say go ahead and go back and look at your application again and re-input the information?
It said go ahead and input the screenshot. It still said denied.
But isn't it fairly characterized as an invitation to reapply?
It is an invitation, but that's not, in the Ted Cruz case, the Supreme Court kind of made that distinction, is that the fact that you're given another alternative does not prevent an individual who's challenging a rule to continue to challenge it.
But it's not another alternative in the sense of, a different approach. It's a do-over. It's an invited do-over, and your position is that still shows injury?
Well, but that was done during the litigation. And they never reopened it. They could have reopened it, and then we were standing, absolutely.
But I thought that email was in the complaint, so it's prior to the litigation.
That email, Your Honor, I believe was issued after the denial. I believe it's July 16, and on July 15 is the date of the decision.
I saw it looking at your complaint, that is correct. Chronologically, you get the denial after that email comes. But also, as I read your complaint in paragraph 130, even after that, July 31st, at least your allegation, whether it's plausible or not, your allegation is that you reached SBA agent Nancy, last name unknown, who confirmed the application had been withdrawn and that no option to reopen or reactivate exists.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So you allege that even after this alleged, please do it again, after four other people have said do it again, you allege that you were told you can't reopen.
That is correct, Your Honor.
This is different. Forgive me, but this is quite different. So you're relying on the assertion of fact now that despite what I'm characterizing as an invitation, that in fact there was a subsequent statement, rescinding that invitation, as opposed to the Ted Cruz case where you said you think as a matter of law this is still an injury. Let me just make sure I got that.
Your Honor, I apologize. I forgot that there was the Nancy last name unknown allegation in the complaint. And that is correct. There was, I think, the after the denial, they will continue to try.
I'm going to take that as a yes, that you're relying on the factual allegation in your complaint as opposed to the legal one. Yes?
I think both, probably. I mean, I think the factual issue is relevant because it was a motion to dismiss.
Very relevant if I disagree with you on the legal proposition, it sounds like. Because it seems to me that an invitation to come back and for a do-over would pretty much dispose of your legal argument. But if you're saying that there was a factual assertion that notwithstanding that invitation, that there still wasn't going to be an avenue for relief, that's quite different. So I take your point, and I'm going to move on.
Well, I'd love to clarify that. Because as I see it, the district court just simply said you didn't trace it. And your response to that would be paragraph 130, we allege that we didn't, it'll be proven. Was it an administrative mess up or was it no amendment policy? But then Ted Cruz, which the district court couldn't have considered and the government hasn't had an opportunity to speak to, is the response to the government's separate argument, which is not, as I understand it, embracing the district court's theory. The government's instead saying, oh no, self-inflicted. And at that point you would have to, someone, it's maybe not us in the first instance, the district court never addressed Ted Cruz, would have to decide, oh, was a causal chain that was alleged, was it broken? That's a totally separate theory. There's been no exploration by that. It certainly wasn't why your client was dismissed.
That is correct, Your Honor. I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. And one last thing I want to point is that because this was motion to dismiss, as the Supreme Court in Bennett, Spears v. Bennett qualified, the traceability at that level is a fairly modest one, and I believe that is the exact quote. So for purpose of a dismissal, the traceability is, again, it is relaxed because it is not a merits issue. It has to, for purposes of standing, the plaintiff must be given the assumption that he will succeed on the merits. And so I think that assumption will carry us over the traceability. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm out of time, but if there are questions that I...
Do you have more that you want to say in response to the question?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. When you come back, we'll put 2 minutes on the clock.
May it please the court, Daniel Aguilar for the Small Business Administration. I think it seems like we've been focusing on the certain allegations in the complaint. And just as a bottom line, we think that this court can and should affirm for the reasons given by the district court. We agree with the district court's reasoning, and I think that's borne out both by the case law and the particular allegations made here. So starting with STAM standing, So what the district court said is that at paragraph 126, it's on ER 216, that's the paragraph where the SBA representative is saying, right, here's the information we need. It's an IRS form that allows us to access your business tax records. It's any update on your business information if that's changed, and it's some additional letter or statements explaining the request for the loan increase, right? Because first, SBA had approved the loan. It had approved the $4,000 loan and said, you're eligible for that. Stam later then said, I want another loan. SBA said, we have two different loans here. We don't know which one to handle. We're granting the $4,000 one. And as the district court recognized, I think this is at ER 16, it lists the various places in the complaint where it says these are the complaint's own allegations that the various plaintiffs, including Stam, made amendments to their original loan applications.
Go too far into the merits, though, whether or not there is an amendment policy. It seems like that's not a jurisdictional question. That seems like a merits question.
I think it goes to sort of Iqbal plausibility standards, right? The claim here is that SBA has a policy of no amendments, but reading the complaint as a whole and fairly, where plaintiffs themselves.
Yeah, Iqbal is a 12B6 standard. This is 12B1, or this is Article 3 standing argument that they had no injury. I think that's very different, and, you know, I think there's a traceability problem, but I don't think that we can determine at the Article 3 stage, injury stage, whether or not there was a no amendment policy.
Well, I think just taking up this case as a hypothetical, just suppose somebody comes into the Small Business Administration and says, I'd like a loan. The SBA says, great, can we have some information? And they say, no. And they say, please give us some information. We can't give you a loan without one, and the person files suit. You know, in that case, I don't think we'd say that, whether you want to think of it as injury or traceability or even remedy, that there's anything really wrong here. The process is to go through and provide the information that the agency's asking for, which is, you want a bigger loan, we need some additional information to process that first.
Just to the point, there was some conflicting information, because apparently it said immediately that it is denied, so... You know, maybe that one email was you know, inviting them to reapply was correct, but that could have been a mistake. I don't know.
But I think what, you know, they get that information. The other plaintiffs, right, amend their complaint to give updates on their citizenship status or immigration status. We're fairly reading it the whole. And what plaintiffs don't dispute and what the district court recognized, I think it's at ER 15, is that there's no allegation, and there has been no allegation by plaintiffs in the complaint, district court briefs, or the briefs on appeal, that they ever sent the requested information to SBA to even try to apply for this loan. And that's where we think...
Give me the best argument of why Cruz doesn't apply here.
So Cruz, as I understand it, and forgive me if I'm mischaracterizing it,
it's confusing.
Applying for a loan during an election and then challenging certain FEC regulations that exactly govern how that loan works and has to be repaid. So there, the regulation there is clear, and the court said it's no answer to say that because you applied for that loan, you don't also get to challenge the regulations that govern it. Here, the question is, have you had injury at all? Is this an improper denial of the loan, or as we think and as the district court said, SBA told you we need some more information and you just never provided it?
And if it were that simple, maybe, but clearly the injury alleged is that they didn't get a loan, a disaster loan they're entitled to.
Well, to be clear, they did get the first loan that they applied for, right? SBA did approve the $4,000 loan and gave them an advance.
And they allege, paragraphs 118 to 130, multiple SBA subcontractors say, you're fine, you're eligible, we'll input it for you. They even allege that the agents told them, we've confirmed it's inputted. But every time they check, it's not.
So
how could that not be that at least an allegation, and I love it as a separate point, if you could give me your case that stands for it has to be plausible as to standing under Ninth Circuit law, that it has to be a plausible allegation. So that's my legal question to you. But I don't see how you could say we're going to resolve whether or not it was them failing to do more or it was SBA employees, at least their allegation, saying we won't put it even though we've told you we've done it. How can they not have alleged that?
Well, so I think it is those paragraphs read fairly along with paragraph 126, which is what the district court recognized, of saying, right, we're asking for this information. If there are, I don't know, some mechanical or computer snafus, we're trying to resolve them. Everybody's trying to work together. And in 126, SBA says, right, maybe something you put on the computer system, I don't know. Here's the exact information that we need. Please send it to us.
But prior, they allege that prior people said, it's all fine, we've done it for you, and we've confirmed we've done it.
And that's true, and they kept asking, and it really is in paragraph 126.
But then what about paragraph 130?
Right, and so paragraph 130 is 2 weeks later, again, after no allegation that they've ever submitted this tax information or reasons for the increase in request, where SBA says, you haven't responded up to us in 2 weeks. We don't know what to do with this. We're treating it at this point as withdrawn.
So their whole complaint, 50-plus pages, multiple paragraphs on this, you're saying the district court even lacked authority because they had no allegation of a case in controversy?
Well, because it is a self-inflicted injury that they didn't try to remedy. And if you're asking... Sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
If you're asking for a Ninth Circuit case on this, I think...
As to plausibility, that has to be a plausible allegation of causality.
Right, and so I think it is Mendia versus Garcia, right? And that's the case where a person was being held in custody, and the court said, right, you're going to be released on bond now. And they say, no, I don't want to leave jail. I think there the allegation was, I'm concerned about being picked up by immigration enforcement if I leave jail. And then the plaintiff files suit later saying, I've been unlawfully incarcerated for this period of time. And a panel of this court said, well, maybe you have standing as to, like, the time before the court ordered your release, but your choice after the court ordered your release and the government said, right, we'll release you, to nevertheless stay in jail is this kind of self-inflicted injury. You don't get to sue over that. And I think the district court's decision is entirely consistent with that underlying logic. I'm happy to keep engaging on standing as well, but otherwise we could turn to the 1611 issue.
If I could start that.
Please go ahead.
Tell me if you disagree with any of these propositions. Poor or prohibits federal aid to non-qualified aliens?
1611, yes. Sorry, I have a hard time pronouncing the acronym. Okay.
The district court says that applies to corporate plaintiffs.
Yes.
Appellant says it clearly does not. Corporations aren't aliens. Correct me if I'm wrong. In your reply brief in support of your 12C motion, you said corporations clearly are not aliens.
I can't remember what's in the reply brief, Your Honor, but if you're representing that, I'll go along with that for this purpose.
Okay, so two questions. Did the district court ever resolve that issue below? And second of all, whether they did or not, yes or no, does Poor's prohibition on federal aid to non-qualified aliens apply to corporations?
So I think the question of whether it applies to any corporation that has any ownership interests, however small, by a non-qualified alien is an issue that I understand why you have concerns about it, and it's not one that this court has to resolve here.
Well, what's the answer, yes or no? And more importantly, the first question, did the district court ever even respond and resolve the plaintiff's argument?
I think what the district court said is this is an easy case for this reason. It is undisputed that the owners of these companies are unqualified aliens, non-qualified aliens, right? That's settled. And then the companies are all wholly owned by the non-qualified aliens. And at that point, it is a reasonable decision by SBA, either in adjudicating the loan applications in the first instance or by working with the standard operating procedure that's been in place since 2018 at least, of saying that these kind of corporations that are wholly owned by non-qualified aliens.
Put aside what the district court said. What is the government's representation as to statutory interpretation? Should INA and POR, does it bar corporations that are wholly owned or in large part owned by aliens? Yes or no? What is the government? What's your authority for that?
My authority for that is the standard operating procedures, which I think make a reasonable determination that a corporation that's 20% or more owned.
So your reliance isn't on the text of the statute or on any case ever interpreting that statute over decades, but it's on SBA's interpretation. So if it is on that.
No, Your Honor, just to be clear, I'm not basing it solely on that. I think it is to the text of the statute as well. You were asking for like a reasonable interpretation, so that's...
No, I was asking for your best authority, and you jumped to the SOP.
I'm happy to jump to the statute itself
as
well.
Has any court ever interpreted the statute in that way?
Surprisingly, in my research, I'm not aware of a court...
Okay, so just going to your first resort, you said the SOP. Am I correct that in 2015, the SBA had also made the same determination made in S-2018?
So as I recall it, the plaintiffs in the statutory addendum were citing different SOPs.
No, I'm not asking what they're citing. I'm guessing you've prepared this. Is there an SOP in 2015 that's identical to 2018, pre-pandemic?
I'm not aware of what.
What about the 2011 SOP?
So, again, the 2011 SOP, I'm not sure if it's for this economic injury program. It's cited in the reply brief, but I'm not sure which one they're referring to. SBA has...
It didn't. by our corporations. So if your position is the POR requires it was the 2011 SOP in violation of federal law.
I mean, if it's a background information and it's trying to apply this, I mean, I can understand how an agency is trying to apply that when it's not in the plain text of the statute. What I am saying here is that it's an easy case because their corporation's wholly owned, and I think I can answer your judge's question this way. If a person were to come up to SBA and say, hi, I would like a loan, and they say, great, are you a small business? They're like, yes, I'm in business for myself. Are you a citizen, national, or a qualified alien? No. Well, I have to deny you the loan under 1611. The person responds, it's okay, I've just made an S corporation for myself. I think it's a reasonable action on behalf of the agency at that point to say, I think whether it's the statute or the standard operating procedures or whatever you want to say, I think it is reasonable to say that you are not eligible for this loan.
Just factually, the denials here didn't say that. There was no reference to 1611.
So the denials said that your loan is denied after they asked for their immigration status, right, in which they said that we're immigrants, we have work visas, but not a lawful permanent resident status. And the basis of plaintiff's complaint for their immigration claims, which is at paragraph 140 and 153 of the complaint, is SBA denied our loans because we're businesses owned by non-qualified aliens. And the reasoning for that claim, and it's been their reasoning through this entirely, is that that is ultra vires because the CARES Act defines eligible entities to simply be businesses under 500 people, and SBA is prohibited from imposing any additional qualifications. I understood opposing counsel today to be walking back from that a bit and saying that the CARES Act should be understood harmoniously with pre-existing statutes and regulations, including businesses, you know, entirely foreign to the United States.
I mean, they get denials. They're not told it's 1611. They're never told it's 1611 by SBA. Until the government in litigation and the district court says, oh, that's what it is, and that's a position you adopt legally in your brief. Brief at page 23, 1611 bars companies in the United States licensed here in good standing, paying taxes, employing U.S. citizens. The government's position, your position today, is 1611 bars them from receiving disaster relief, where your brief says the whole point is to keep Americans employed. That would be a very consequential ruling.
Again, we're not asking for a broad, sweeping interpretation of law.
But that's the brief's position you took legally.
Yes, Your Honor, because this is an easy case, because these are companies that are wholly owned by non-qualified aliens. I think one of them only operates two trucks, right? These are small businesses where the sole owners are people who Congress determined ought not to get federally issued loans.
Persons, Congress's INA statute, unless you can give me a case, said people, asylees, refugees, never been said to be business companies in good standing in the United States.
Your Honor, two responses to that. The first is that Congress does not enact self-defeating statutes, and for the hypothetical I gave earlier where every non-qualified alien could simply make a corporation or even a partnership or a sole proprietorship, I guess, which has a corporate form to it, right, and then receive loans that Congress said are not able to go to individuals, I think that that's not a tenable interpretation of the statute. But then I'd also just point out to the
Canadians, Mexicans, these are beneficial owners. The employees that are getting the aid are U.S. citizens.
And then the other point that I would make, Your Honor, is that the broad form of plaintiff's argument, right, which they've consistently pushed in district court and the court here, is that SBA is not allowed to consider any additional qualifications other than what's in the CARES Act.
I think what they're really saying is you might have the authority under the SBA, but you sure have to put it up for notice and comment. You can't just wiggle around with different SOPs. What about saying, oh, U.S. companies that are employed, that are owned by previously convicted felons or are owned by veterans that were dishonorably discharged? Can the SBA just announce that with no notice and comment?
I think if there is a statute that implements that requirement, I think then a legislative rule is not necessary. And our argument here, and what I think the district court held that is correct, is that 1611, as consistently applied by the SBA in a number of different ways, prohibits wholly owned corporations of non-qualified aliens from receiving federally issued loans. I know of no case where federally issued loans using federal money have been given to non-qualified aliens. They point to the Paycheck Protection Program, but those involve loans that are issued lawyers using private money. And so I don't think it's the same program that's at issue here.
Yeah, counsel, so is this issue even properly before us? Because I understood the argument, as you did, that you know, the CARES Act is a wholly independent statute, and you don't read it with it behind any background rules of Priora or SBA Act. But it seems like it's changing now. Was this fully engaged in the opening brief?
So I will give you my interpretation of it. I'm not trying to limit this court's consideration of anything if the court thinks that is properly before it. My understanding through the litigation until we received the reply brief was twofold. One is that we can't consider anything that's not in the CARES Act itself defining eligibility standards, because that's how it was litigated in the district court. That's how the district court ruled. And two is both on the immigration claims and the complaint, particularly at ER 219, 221, and then the arbitrary and capricious claim, which is at 224 to 28, the characterizations there are really that all of this action is ultra vires because the eligibility criteria are set forth in the CARES Act without additional qualifications.
Okay, three questions. Number one, the government raises this issue, 1611, in the district court. The government raised it affirmatively. District court neglected to bring it up. Correct me if I'm wrong. Second of all, you say first time you see it is the reply brief, but it's throughout your red brief.
I'm sorry, you're talking. I wasn't talking about 16.
Are corporations aliens under PWRA? That issue was raised below. It was not answered by the district court. You raise it extensively. Well, what is it that you haven't answered as to that issue in the red brief?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think what was surprising about the reply brief was trying to draw this clear bright line distinction, saying that the corporate form is inherently different from individuals, and therefore their 1611 can never apply to anything outside of that. That's odd, particularly because opposing counsel here agrees that we could deny loans to non-qualified alien businesses that are sole proprietorships or partnerships where it's still
is a corporate form. You don't disagree that in your brief repeatedly, I think I counted page 3, page 21, page 23, you are saying 1611 prohibits because corporations are aliens under INA and WAR. What else would you say if the first time you're hearing any of this is in the reply brief? What else would you want to file supplementally to us?
The only distinction that I'm making here, Your Honor, is a bright-line categorical rule that 1611 can never apply to corporate entities that are wholly owned by non-qualified aliens. I don't think that was put into stark relief that plaintiffs were particularly relying upon that until the reply brief. The majority of the discourse, both in the opening brief and in district court and in the complaint, were that SBA cannot consider anything else outside of the CARES Act. And I think that that position is not well taken, particularly because of the Second and Eleventh Circuit decisions we rely on, which says that Congress enacted the CARES Act against the backdrop of pre-existing rules and regulations about
the you engaged on that issue. And have you ever said that any issue here was forfeited?
Again, that's why I said I'm not trying to tell the court what's properly before it or not.
No, I'm asking you whether you did, in your brief, allege that they forfeited any issue.
No, Your Honor, and I'm not pushing that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't raised until the reply brief, so I don't know what opportunity you had to say it was forfeited.
Again, I'm just trying to be descriptive about it. I'm not trying to hold it
because it's very important to know the government's position, even as a result of the reply brief. Are you telling us there's an issue of law that we shouldn't reach because it was forfeited? If so, define that issue.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
That's what I thought. But I guess my question is, Judge Higgins has asked if you've addressed this issue in your answering brief. And as I read the answering brief, it's more as a background statement of the law. Did you engage in an actual analysis of whether or not 1611 applies to corporations?
No, we thought that was pretty self-evident, the best reading of the statute, because otherwise individuals could merely take a corporate form and otherwise obtain the funds. We thought that was common sense and the best interpretation. One other point in terms of hurricane and disaster relief, I do understand that that's important. I think it's 1611 defines the federal public benefits to exclude interim short-term disaster relief. So, you know, medicine and supplies getting to people is not considered a federal public benefit that can't get to non-qualified aliens. That goes out to everybody.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
We'll hear from opposing counsel for 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to what counsel said, if I may switch my screen just to read for my opening brief, page 45-46, And we specifically said, not very artfully, to accept defendant's approach as reasonable one, one must consider a corporation to be the same as its owner. It is well settled.
I have those pages right up on the screen. I've got them right here.
You said 44.
45 and 46. So we definitely, that was the argument below, is that corporate formation has never been disregarded the way counsel is arguing. Now, with our complaint, we list the Small Business Act. We list all the regulations. So that was not only raised below, but it's part of our complaint. And I think it's relevant to think that, to consider that the Small Business Act, what they administer specifically in defining hub zone small concern, states that such a small concern must be 51% owned by the United States citizen. Now, that is specifically in the Small Business Act. So counsel coming in and pulling out the whole cloth, the whole wholly owned, not so. The last point I want to make is a factual one. PPP is part of the CARES Act. It is not funds from the lenders. It is a PPP, specifically CARES Act provision, which was given to companies even when they didn't have social security number. So that was raised before the court below, and it is part of our reply brief. So to say that it is okay to exclude people with pending adjustment status application with work authorization simply because they are incorporated or shareholders, but to grant PPP loans under the CARES Act, or to grant restaurant relief grants under the CARES Act, or to provide credit benefits to people who are non-qualified, would make it totally irrational. Congress knew how to define qualified aliens. They did know how the priora worked. They never incorporated, in fact, in the CARES Act, departed from 1641. So if the court has any questions.
No, we want to thank you both for your very careful preparation and argument. We'll take this case under advisement, and we'll stand in recess.